Let us revert to our original illustration about crossing the street. Let us decide that we can easily cross the street on a 2-foot plank resting across the roadway. Then, by faith, by thinking that we are not as others, we can persuade our imagination that we can cross the plank even though it be elevated 20 stories above the ground. Think of this, tell yourself that even a more or less brainless monkey can cross that plank with no fear at all. Who is better, you or a brainless monkey? If a brainless monkey or a person who is almost an idiot can cross that plank, then surely you, a much better person, can do so also. It is merely a question of practice, of having faith. In the past there have been famous tightrope walkers such as Blondin, who crossed a rope many times over the Niagara Falls. Blondin was just an ordinary man who had faith in his abilities. He had faith that he could cross where other men could not. He knew that the only thing to be afraid of was of being afraid. He knew that if he was confident of going across, then he could cross no matter if he was pushing a wheelbarrow or if he was blindfolded. We all get the same sort of experience. We climb up a long ladder, and as long as we look up, we experience no fear. But as soon as we look down, the thought occurs to us that we would make an awfully bad mess if we fell off the ladder and then crashed. Our imagination then pictures ourselves falling, pictures us being smeared many, many feet below. Our imagination might picture us clinging so tightly to that ladder that we cannot free ourselves. Steeplejacks have had that type of experience. If you control your imagination by building up faith in your own abilities, you can do anything. You cannot succeed in overcoming your imagination by force. Exercising your willpower will not overcome your imagination, it will instead build up a neurosis within you. Remember, once again, that you must at all times lead your imagination, control your imagination. If you try to drive your imagination, you will fail. If you will lead your imagination, you will be able to do all those things which, 164, you thought would be impossible for you. First of all, though, believe that there is no such thing as impossible. Lesson 24. People may have heard of the law of karma. Unfortunately, so many of these metaphysical matters have been given Sanskrit or Brahman names. In much the same way, medical terms, anatomical terms, and, in fact, many scientific terms, have Latin names. Latin names can indicate a type of flower, or a bulb, or the action of a particular muscle or artery. The purpose of this originated in the days of long ago. Many years ago, doctors tried to keep their knowledge to themselves, and the doctors of those days were the only ones who had any worthwhile education. Studying Latin was a must, and so it became necessary for doctors to use Latin as a means of concealing technical terms from those who were not educated, that is, those who were not doctors. This habit persisted right up to the present day. There are certain advantages, of course, in having technical terms all in one language, because it doesn't matter what is the native language of a scientist, he can still manage quite well by discussing things with a foreign scientist in Latin. Radio operators aboard ship or on aircraft have much the same idea when they use the Morse code or what is known as the Q code. Often you will find that radio amateurs who keep in touch with other amateurs throughout the world use code so that they can communicate intelligently even though they normally will not understand a word of each other's language. Sanskrit is a language which is known to advance to cultists throughout the world, so that if one refers to karma, one gets a particular picture of what we could term the law of cause and effect. You see, karma is nothing at all mysterious, nothing at all frightening. In this course we want to put metaphysics upon what we consider to be a rational basis. We do not want to use abstract terms because to our way of thinking nothing in metaphysics is so difficult as to warrant the use of terms which often actually conceal one's meaning. Let us take the law of karma out of its metaphysical connotation, let us forget about metaphysics, and let us instead consider the law of 165, the land. Here is what we mean. Little Johnny so-and-so has just been given a motorcycle. He finds that there is a great thrill in sitting on this powerful machine and letting the engine race and make what is to him a wondrous noise. But sitting upon the machine is not good enough. Little Johnny so-and-so lets in the clutch and rides away, sedately perhaps at first, but then the joy of movement overcomes him and he goes faster and faster, oblivious of warning signs. Suddenly there is a blaring hoot behind him and a police car pulls up alongside and motions him into the curb. Little Johnny so-and-so glumly slows down and pulls off the road. Even more glumly he waits with considerable apprehension for the policeman who is going to give him a ticket for going far above the permitted speed limit in a built-up area. In this simple little example we have seen that there are certain laws. In this case the law was that no one could travel at more than a certain speed. Johnny so-and-so ignored that and so retribution in the form of a policeman came along and gave him a ticket so that Johnny so-and-so would have to pay a fine and go to court as punishment for having broken the law. Another example? All right. Bill James is a bit of a lazy fellow. He doesn't like work at all, but he has a very expensive girlfriend. He can only keep his girlfriend's interest so long as he can provide her with the things that she wants. It doesn't matter to her. She thinks, how Bill James gets the things she wants, so long as she gets them. So, one evening Bill James sets out with the intention of robbing some store in the hope of obtaining enough money so that he can buy his girlfriend whatever it is that she wants. A mink coat? A platinum diamond studded watch? Well, no matter what she wants, Bill James, with her full knowledge and approval, sets out to do this burglary. Very silently he creeps up to the building and prowls around seeking for some mode of entry. Soon he decides that he will get in what appears to be quite an inviting window. It is at a convenient height for him, so with the skill of much practice he slides a penknife through the window panes and forces back the catch. Easily he raises the sash, and then stops for a moment to listen. Has he made any noise? Is anyone about? Satisfied at last he eases himself up and crawls through the open window. The 166 is not a sound, not a creak. Quietly in stocking feet he pads through the store taking the things he wants, jewelry from cases, a pocketful of watches, and from a cash box in the manager's office he takes quite a pile of notes. Satisfied with his loot, he creeps back to the window and looks out. There is no one there. He retrieves his shoes and makes his way to a door, thinking that it would be so much easier to get out of a door than to creep through a window and possibly damage some of the stolen articles. Silently he eases back the bolts and walks out. A few steps into the darkness of the night and a sudden harsh voice says, "Stop! I have you covered." Bill James freezes with fright. He knows the police are armed, he knows the police will not hesitate to shoot. A light pierces the darkness and shines full upon his face. Glumly he raises his hands above his head, figures materialize and he finds that he is surrounded by police. Quickly they search him for weapons and relieve him of all the very valuable items which he had stolen from the store. He is led off to a waiting police car and is soon ensconced in a cell. Some hours later the girlfriend of Bill James is awakened from her sleep by a policeman and a police matron. She is very, very indignant and not a little hysterical when she is told that she is to be arrested. Arrested? Yes, of course, for Bill James's girlfriend was an accessory before the fact, and she, by inciting him to do that which he knew was wrong, is as much guilty as is Bill James. The laws of life are like that. Now let us take it away from the physical world for a moment and tell you that karma is a mental or physical act which builds up good or bad. There is an old saying, as ye sow so shall ye reap. It means just that. If you are going to sow bad deeds you will reap a bad future either in the next life, or the next, or the one after that. If in this life you sow good, if you show goodness and kindness and compassion to those in need, then when your own turn comes to have misfortune, someone, somewhere, will show you kindness and consideration and compassion. Make no mistake about this. If a person is suffering hardship now it may not be because that person is evil, it may be to see how the person reacts under hardship, under suffering, it may be a process of refining to drive away by suffering some of the impurities, some of the selfishness of humanity. Everyone, be he prince or beggar, travels, 167, along what we call the wheel of life, the circle of endless existence. A man may be a king in one life, but in the next he may be a beggar traveling afoot from city to city, perhaps trying to get work and failing, or perhaps just drifting along like a leaf blowing before a gale. There are some people who are exempt from the laws of karma, so it is useless for you to say, "Oh, what a terrible life that person has had. He must have been a terrible sinner in a previous life." The higher entities, whom we call avatars, come down to earth in order that certain tasks may be accomplished. The Hindus, for instance, believe that the god Vishnu descends onto earth at various times in order to bring to mankind once again the truths of religion which mankind is so prone to forget. This avatar, or advanced being, will often come to live, perhaps, as an example of poverty, but to show what can be done in the way of compassion, in the way of what seems to be immunity to suffering. Nothing could be further from the truth about this immunity to suffering, for the avatar, being of finer material, suffers the more acutely. The avatar is not born because he has to be. He is not born that he may work out his karma. Instead, he comes to earth as an embodied soul. His birth is the result of free choice, or under certain conditions he may not even be born, he may take over the body of another. We do not want to tread on anyone's corns in the matter of religious beliefs, but if one will read the Christian Bible closely, one will understand that Jesus, the man, was born of Joseph and Mary, but in the fullness of time and when Jesus was a grown man, Jesus wandered into the wilderness and the Spirit of Christ, the Spirit of God, descended and filled the body of Jesus. In other words, it was a case that another soul came and possessed the willing body of Jesus, the son of Joseph and Mary. We mention this, though, because we do not like to think that some people are being blamed for misfortunes and poverty when actually they come to help others by showing what may be accomplished by misfortune and poverty. Everything we do results in some action. Thought is a very real force indeed. As you think, so you are. Thus, if you think of pure things you become pure, if you think of lust then you become lustful and, 168, contaminated, and you have to come back to earth time after time until desire withers within you under the onslaught of purity and good thinking. No person is ever destroyed, no person is ever so bad that they are condemned to everlasting punishment. The everlasting punishment was a device started by the priests of old who wanted to maintain discipline over their somewhat unruly flock. Christ never taught eternal suffering, eternal damnation. Christ taught that if a person repented and tried, then a person would be saved from his own folly and given a chance and a chance again. Karma, then, is the process whereby we incur debts and we pay off those debts. If you go into a store and you order certain goods, then you are incurring certain debts which have to be paid for in coin of the realm. Until you have paid for those goods you are a debtor, and if you do not pay for the articles you can, in some countries, be arrested to be made a bankrupt. Everything has to be paid for by the ordinary man, woman and child upon the earth. Only the avatar is immune from the laws of karma. So those who are not avatars had better try to lead a good life so that they may cut short their sojourn on this earth. For there is much better on other planets and on other planes of existence. We should forgive those that trespass against us, and we should seek the forgiveness of those against whom we trespass. We should always remember that the surest way to a good karma is to do to others as we would have them do to us. Karma is a matter which few of us can escape. We make a debt, we have to pay it. We do good to others, they must pay us back and do good to us. It is much better for us to receive good, so let us show good, compassion and kindness to all creatures, no matter what their species, remembering that in the eyes of God all men are equal, and in the eyes of great God all creatures are equal, whether they be cats, horses, what will you call them? God, it is stated, works in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. It is not for us to question the ways of God, but it is for us to work out the problems allotted to us, for only in working out our problems and bringing them to a satisfactory conclusion can we pay off karma. Some people have a sick relative with whom they must live, some people have, 169, this sick relative living with them and they think, "Oh, how tiresome! Why cannot he die and be out of his misery?" The answer is, of course, that both are working out a planned lifespan, working out a planned form of existence. The person who is looking after the sick one may have planned to come just for that purpose. We should at all times show great care, great concern, great understanding for those who are ill or sorrowing or are afflicted, for it may be that our task is to show such care and such understanding. It is too easy to brush off a tiresome person with an impatient gesture, but those who are sick are most frequently very highly sensitive. They feel their disabilities. They feel very keenly that they are in the way, not wanted. We would again remind you that as things are on earth at present, every person who is truly occult, every person who can do the major occult arts has some physical disability. Thus, in spurning, in rudely brushing off an appeal for help from some sick person, you may be brushing off a person who is far, far more gifted than you can ever imagine. We have no interest in football or any of those strenuous sports. But we do want to ask you this question. Have you ever heard of a strong, rugged sportsman or sportswoman who was clairvoyant or could even spell the word? The process of some physical disability is often a process of refining a gross human body so that it can receive vibrations of a higher frequency than can the average human. So, show consideration to those who are sick, will you? Do not be impatient with a sick person. For the sick person has many problems with which you are unacquainted. There is a selfish side to it too. The sick person may be far more evolved than you who are healthy, and in helping that sick person you could indeed help yourself immensely. Lesson 25. Have you ever been suddenly, devastatingly, shockingly deprived of a dearly loved one? Have you ever felt that the sun had retreated behind the clouds, never, never to shine for you again? The loss of one who is dear indeed is tragic, tragic for you, and tragic for the one who has gone on before. If you keep on making unnecessary drags, 170, we are going to talk about subjects which are usually regarded as sad, as gloomy, in this lesson. But if we regarded things as we should perceive that death is not really a time for mourning, not really a time for sorrowing. Let us have a look first at what happens when we are aware that a loved one has passed on to that stage which people of earth call death. We are going along in our normal way, possibly untroubled by any care or by any vexation. Then, suddenly, like a bolt from the blue, we are informed that this dearly beloved person is no longer with us. Immediately we feel our pulse race, we feel that the lacrimal ducts of our eyes get ready to shed moisture to relieve the tension within. We find that no longer do we see bright rosy cheerful colors, instead everything looks gloomy, everything looks sad, as though suddenly a bright summer's day had been replaced by one of complete midwinter with leaden overcast skies. Once again we come to our old friends the electrons, for when we are suddenly afflicted with sadness, with grief, the voltage generated in our brains alters. It may even change its direction of flow, so that if we were seeing the world through rose-colored spectacles before, then after the receipt of the sad news we see the world through spectacles which make everything gloomy, everything depressing. That is just a natural physiological function in the mundane plane, but in the astral plane we are depressed also because of the horrible drag which our physical vehicle gives us when we try to go to greet the one who has newly arisen into what is, after all, the greater life, the happier life. It is sad indeed to have a loved friend go off to a far distant country, but upon earth we console ourselves with the thought that we can always write a letter, send a cable, or even use a telephone. So-called death, on the other hand, does not appear to leave any room for communication. Do you think that the dead are beyond reach? You could be greatly and joyously mistaken. We say to you that there are various scientists in reputable scientific centers of the world who are actually working on an instrument which will be capable of communicating with those to whom we must refer as disembodied spirits. This is not a pipe dream, it is not a fantastic thought, it is an item of news which has been bruited about for quite a number of years, 171. And according to the latest scientific reports, there is at last some hope that such developments may soon become public knowledge, public property. But before we can get in touch with those who have passed beyond our immediate reach, we can do much to help them. When a person dies, the physiological functions, that is, the actual working of the physical body, slows down and eventually stops. We have seen in the preliminary stages of this course that a human brain can live for minutes only when deprived of oxygen. The human brain, then, is one of the first portions of the body to die. Obviously, when the brain is dead, death is utterly inevitable. We have a special reason for making this what appears to be a long drawn-out affair. After the death of the brain, other organs deprived of the commands and the guidance of the brain subside into quiescence, that is, they become like a motor car which has been deserted by the driver. The driver had switched off the ignition and left the vehicle. The engine may give a few kicks over by its own momentum, and then gradually the car will cool. As it cools, one will get little clicks and grunts and squeaks from contracting metal. The same with the human body. As one organ follows another into that stage which we call dissolution, there are various creaks and grunts and twitches of muscles. Over a period of some 3 days, the astral body completely and permanently disengages its hold of the physical body. The silver cord, which we may say roots the astral body to the physical, gradually withers in much the same way as the umbilical cord of a baby withers when cut, when the baby is separated from the mother. For 3 days the astral body is kept in more or less close contact with the decaying physical. A person who has died has an experience something like this. The person is in bed, possibly surrounded by sorrowing relatives or friends. There comes a shuddering gasp in the throat, and the final rattle of death, and then the last harsh breath is exhaled through the teeth. The heart races for a moment, slows, flutters, and stops, permanently. There are various tremors of the body. Gradually the body becomes colder, but at the instant of death itself a clairvoyant can see a shadowy form emerge from the physical vehicle and float upwards like a silvery mist, float up to lie directly above the dead body. Over a period of the 3 days the silver cord connecting the two darkens. Eventually it, 172, turns black where it enters the body. Then one gets an impression of black dust flying off that part of the cord which is still connected to the body. At last the cord drops loose and the astral form is free to rise properly and to get its introduction to the life above the astral. First, though, it has to look down and see this dead body which it used to inhabit. Often the astral form will accompany a hearse to the cemetery and will actually witness the funeral proceedings. There is no pain, no distress, no upset caused by this, because the astral, in the case of a person unprepared by knowledge such as that contained within this course, is in a state of semi-shock. It follows the body in the coffin in much the same way as a kite will follow a small boy at the other end of a string, or in much the same way as a balloon follows the trailer car which holds it from escaping. Soon, though, this silver cord, silver no longer, parts. And then the astral body is free to go up and up, and to prepare for its second death. This second death is completely and absolutely painless. Before the second death, a person has to go to the hall of memories and see all that happened in his life. You are not judged by anyone except yourself, and there is no greater judge, no sterner judge than yourself. When you see yourself stripped of all the petty conceits, all the false values that were dear to you upon the earth, you may find that in spite of all the money you have left behind, in spite of all the positions you have held, all the appointments, you are not so great after all. Very, very frequently the most humble, the most lowly and the poorest in money, get the most satisfactory and highest judgment. After having seen yourself in the hall of memories, then you go on to that portion of the other world which you think is most suitable for you. You do not go to hell, believe us when we say that hell is upon earth, our training school. You will probably know that people in the East, great mystics, great teachers, never let their true name be known, because there is much power in names, and if all and sundry can call upon one in the correct vibration of one's name, then one is pulled irresistibly back to gaze upon the earth. In some parts of the East, and in some parts of the West, too, God is known as he whose name may not be spoken. That is because if everyone kept calling on God, then the leader of this world, 173, would have a most harrowing time. Many teachers adopt a name which is not their own, a name which differs markedly from the pronunciation of their true name, for names, remember, consist of vibrations, of chords and harmonics, and if one is called by what is one's own harmonic combination of vibrations, then one is greatly distracted from any work which one may be doing at the time. Sorrowing unduly for those who have passed over causes them pain, causes them to feel dragged down to the earth. They are much the same as a man who has been cast into the water and feels himself dragged down by soggy clothes and heavy boots. Let us consider again this matter of vibrations, for vibration is the essence of life upon this earth, and in fact upon any and all worlds. We all know a very simple illustration of the power of vibration. Soldiers who are marching along keeping step will break back that step and walk across a big bridge in any disordered array of bases. The bridge may be capable of withstanding the heaviest mechanized traffic, it may be capable of bearing a whole succession of armored tanks rattling across, or it may bear a whole load of railway locomotives, and it will not deviate more than its designated amount through that load. Yet let a column of men march in step across that bridge, and it will set up a momentum which causes the bridge to sway and bounce, and eventually to collapse. Another illustration we might give in the matter of vibration is that of the violinist. If he takes his violin, he can, by playing a single note for some seconds, cause vibrations to build up in a wine glass, with the result that the glass will shatter with a surprisingly loud explosion. The soldiers is one end of our illustration on vibration, and the other end? Let us consider OM. If one can say the words 0 meters mani padme om in a certain way and keep on saying that for a few minutes, one can build up a vibration of quite fantastic strength. So, remember that names are powerful things, and those who have passed over should not be called unduly, nor should they be called in sorrow or grief, for why should our sorrow be allowed to penalize them and make them suffer? Have they not suffered enough already? We may wonder why we come to this earth and suffer death, but the 174 answer is that dying refines one, suffering refines one, provided that it be not too much suffering. And again, we must remind you that in nearly every case, there are certain special exceptions. No man or woman is ever called upon to bear greater suffering or sorrow than meets his or her particular need of refining at that moment. You will appreciate this when you think of a woman who can swoon with sorrow. The swoon is merely a safety valve so that she is not overburdened with sorrow, so that nothing happens to injure her. Often a person who has suffered a great sorrow will be numb with grief. Here again, the numbness is a mercy to the one who is left and to the one who has gone on. Numbness can cause the bereaved to be aware of the loss and so to undergo the refining process, but in being aware of the loss he or she is not unbearably tormented. The person who has passed over is protected by the numbness of the bereaved, because if the numbness were not present, perhaps the bereaved, with wailing and lamentations in full possession of his or her faculties, would cause great stress, great drags on the person who had newly passed over. In the fullness of time, it may be that all of us will be able to communicate with those who have passed over in much the same way as we can now use a telephone to get in touch with those who are in some distant city of the world. By studying this course conscientiously, by having faith in yourself and in the greater powers of this life and of the next life, you too should be able to get in touch with those who have passed over. It is possible to do so by telepathy, it is possible to do so by clairvoyance and by so-called automatic writing. In this latter, however, one must keep clear of one's own distorted imagination, one must control one's imagination so that the message which is written out, apparently subconsciously, does not emanate from our consciousness nor from our subconscious, but comes instead directly from one who has passed over and who can see us, although most of us cannot, for the moment, see them. Be of good cheer, be of good faith, for believing you can accomplish miracles. Is it not written that faith can move mountains? It certainly can. 175, Lesson 26. We are going to set down now what we term rules for right living. These are completely basic rules, rules which are definitely a must. To them you should add your own rules. First we will set them down and then we will go over them again, examining them more carefully so that we may perhaps have some insight into the reasons behind them. Here they are then. 1. Do as you would be done by. 2. Do not judge others. 3. Be punctual in all that you do. 4. Do not argue about religion nor scoff at the beliefs of others. 5. Keep to your own religion and show complete tolerance to those who are of a different religion. 6.